If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group, or if you've had an experience with manipulation or abuse of power you'd like to share,
shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two lucid dreamers who've actually experienced it. I'm Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth.
And today our guest is Lynn Short. She's a former member of a group called the New Gnostic Society, an Armageddon cult with a mishmash of beliefs from different religions. So we're going to talk about how the man she was in love with introduced her to this group that emphasized lucid dreaming and withholding your orgasms to collect your spiritual energy, and the shame that became attached to sex as a result.
She'll also tell us about the group's original guru, Samael, whom they referred to as Master, what happened to the group after he died, and how she became not just a member, but a missionary. Plus the idea of spiritualizing depression and what led to her finally leaving the group.
Yes, 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 yes. I said this already in the interview, but surprise, I had never heard of this group before. It sounds, their beliefs are just super, super interesting, I would have imagined. But yeah, I'm so glad we got to talk to Lynn, you guys. It's a really good interview. If I don't say so myself.
Say it.
Because of her, not us. Because of her. Megan. What's your cultiest thing of the week?
Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm reading in the news that these girls in Vermont, they're in college, they're on the rugby team, just got hazed so badly. It's Nexium level, Lola.
I didn't click on it yet. So tell me about it.
They're getting branded with lighters and like weird metal shit. They waterboarded a girl.
Oh my God.
Waterboarded someone to be on the fucking rugby team, dude.
Dude.
And then the fact that this girl is like talking to the police, she's getting shamed and shunned, and you want to play rugby, so you have to get waterboarded and branded?
Makes you a better athlete.
Yeah. So we are desperately looking for people who had to go through some sort of hazing. We would love to talk to you.
Seriously.
It can be anonymously, whatever you want. But if you had to go through something like that, I would love to talk to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a thing. It's happening. And for some reason, we have not been able to find anyone.
Well, because it's so looked down upon to talk about.
Yeah. I guess if you're still like cool with your fellow sorority or fraternity people.
Yeah, and if it's not a religion, if it's just something fun, it's harder to get turned off by them, you know?
Yeah, but for sure there are frats abusing people. For sure that's happening still.
I remember this one girl, she went to an Ivy League school. She was my friend in high school, and I remember her telling me they're circling our fat and making us sit on the dryer and then having it like turning on the dryer and then saying that's where it's jiggling.
Ew.
And so when we started this podcast, I contacted her and was like, I remember you telling me this. And she's like, I didn't say that. And I was like, okay. Of course you didn't. I must have made that up in my head.
Wow.
But people are scared. So.
Yeah, it's fair. It's fair. It's a hard thing to come forward about anything. I do understand that.
Absolutely.
But yeah, if anyone wants to, we're here.
What about you?
This is not, this like barely counts because I literally watched most of one episode and did not even keep going yet. But this morning I finally started Bad Vegan.
Okay.
My primary conclusion so far is just that we should never meet men on the internet.
Interesting.
Even though technically I met my boyfriend on Hinge, I feel like every story that I've been hearing lately is about a woman meeting some guy who is like presenting this idea of himself through either a dating app or, in her case, it was Words with Friends, I think.
And Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just want to say this is kind of a spoiler alert, but it's not really. And actually, I might be wrong. So any listeners who want to correct me on this, we never learn why Alec Baldwin was retweeting him or why he has this relationship with Alec Baldwin. We never
wow,
found that out.
Spoiler,
so I'd be very
Megan.
Interested. Yeah, spoiler. I know that's why you're watching it. What's Alec Baldwin got to do with it? But I am very curious about how that relationship started, because it feels like a big part of his con.
Honestly, yeah, that's super interesting. Well, I mean, it was also in 2011, and I feel like Twitter in 2011 was such a different place, where like it was very easy to be, if you were funny on Twitter, it was easy to get people to like follow you.
Mm, okay.
That's my recollection anyway. I still follow a couple people from that era where I was like, oh, that's super funny. They're super funny. That's like, it was almost kind of like being a celebrity if someone's tweets were really funny or their political tweets are really interesting or something.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's still kind of a thing, but you just have to have much more followers.
But he wasn't funny. I mean, his jokes were like, Mr. Fox says yes. That's not funny.
I just assumed that they were in a context in which they must have been found to be charming. I don't, you know, they don't hit the same anymore, but they like must have hit at the time.
Okay.
No.
All right.
I keep hearing stories of women and even, you know, Tara's mom, like I keep hearing stories of women meeting these guys who seem to be the perfect man who's going to like sweep them off their feet and fix all their problems. And it's not that you shouldn't meet men on the internet. It's that you shouldn't meet men who claim to be rich on the internet.
Oh, there it is. And if they are claiming to be rich, and they have a reason why they're not currently
why they
having
need your money.
Hints of richness. Yeah.
If they're rich, but they just suddenly really, they just need $10,000, like just for a little, just for right now, just until they get paid, maybe fucking run.
Yeah. But somebody does need to write a romance novel about like an actual prince who gets lost in a small town. And it's just like, I need $10,000 to get home. And this girl's like, fine. And everyone's like, you're an idiot. And then she marries him. People say that the cultiest things at the beginning of this podcast can get too long, but that was a really great point we just made.
I think so too. And you know what? Other people say they want to hear it for longer. So you know what?
So what?
It sounds like it's the right length exactly.
Anyway, no one write that book. It's mine.
I will read it. But okay, so great. Let's start talking to Lynn now, shall we?
Okay, yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Welcome, Lynn Short, to the show. Thank you so much for reaching out to us and coming on and talking to us today.
Absolutely.
So you were in a group that we were, before we were recording just now, we were saying we were kind of shocked that people don't know about it because it seems like definitely one of the cultier cults in a lot of ways. So it was the New Gnostic Society. So can you just start us at the very beginning? How did you hear about it? How did you join? What was going on?
Okay. I was 30-something at the time, and I had just moved to a new city. I was without family, without familiar friends, also jobless. I had just graduated from massage school, so trying to get my license and this, that stuff takes time, and building a business takes time. So I was in a vulnerable place. The person I was in love with, who was dating somebody else, side note, was really into New Age stuff and had like books on lucid dreaming, and I noticed this, and found a flyer as I was wandering Portland, and it was on lucid dreaming. And I thought, oh, he and his girlfriend will be super into this. And so I brought him home the flyer, and he was super into it and she wasn't. And I had nothing going on and I was in love with this man. So I was like, well, hey, I'll check it out with you. I got nothing but time on my hands. So we went to the first class, and I want a caveat in saying that the teaching is of a dead guru taught by living people. Mm-hmm. So we didn't meet the guru. Mm-hmm. We met a missionary. Mm. So this particular missionary that we met, he was very charismatic and really felt very strongly about this path and was telling us all about it. And like, kind of gave us a sprinkling of like the magic of it, in that this will be the path of your life. Like, this will solve all of your problems, and you will understand the world in a completely different way. And it's true. You've probably seen those pictures of like red string and attaching things to.
Yeah,
it's exactly that. It's like this amazing worldview of like, oh my God, that means that this is connected to that and this is connected to that.
The word I kept seeing was integration. Like, you're trying to integrate everything. Everything's connected. Yeah.
Yep. So the person who created the religion, Samael, he was born in Colombia, and he was told by his spirit or whatever being that he was to create the synthesis of all world religions, and this would be the new Gnosis, and to give it to humanity.
Yeah, so it's like Kabbalah, Christianity,
Hinduism,
Buddhism, yeah.
It's kind of an amalgamation of all of that, as well as a lot of really old, late 1800s, early 1900s occult stuff. So
right.
Gurdjieff and Blavatsky and Steiner, if you know those names. Person who created the religion, he himself plagiarized a lot off of that, because this was all in an era when you couldn't fact check someone.
Right.
And he was in Colombia and he was in Mexico, and some of the people he was around could read and some could not. So they're not doing any fact checking or critical thinking about his stuff.
Right. I felt like I saw some language on there that reminded me of like Aleister Crowley, and
totally. This is kind of serving me Scientology vibes, you know? Like, hey, do you want to come to our acting workshop? Like, does this religion actually have a lot to do with lucid dreaming, or is this just a way to get people to come to something?
Lucid dreaming is one of the key components, the key practices, because the idea is that if you lucid dream, then you can verify the teachings, because you can ask questions and you can say certain mantras.
Whoa.
And you can pray about something.
Fascinating.
And you'll get an experience. And that, because you're not on the third plane anymore, the third physical plane, you are in a higher dimension. You are thus closer to what truth with a capital T would be.
Whoa.
Because you don't have your mental mind getting in the way of the truth.
This is blowing my mind.
Yeah. Whenever I lucid dream, though, I just end up having sex. Is
same,
that what happens?
Same.
Yeah. It's so disappointing. So if anybody's meeting their angels and communicating, that's very
90%
admirable.
Of my lucid dreams were me as a Mormon girl being like, oh, I'm not allowed to have sex in real life. I better have sex in my dream. Better have sex in my dream.
Yeah, that would be a big no-no in Gnosis.
Really?
You're supposed to conjure the space, and you know, if you say these prayers, the atmosphere of the dream does change. So that's your proof, right? That's your proof. And it's basically you're just pulling out of whatever you're dreaming,
right?
And you're focusing your mind while you're sleeping on something else.
Yeah.
And so then you can investigate the teachings, and so you can meet Jesus or Buddha or Samael. And
wow, this is so fucking fascinating, because you are like, it's one thing to try to generate spiritual experiences for people in their waking life, but if you can get them to become conscious in their dream life, of course they're going to generate a spiritual experience. They're freaking dreaming. Anything can happen. Like, what, that's such ripe I'm actually shocked now that I'm hearing about it that more groups haven't like sort of utilized this and made this into the way to manipulate people into thinking they're having a spiritual experience.
Yeah. For the listener out there who's using all of our episodes to create the one super cult.
This is how you do it.
Yes, exactly. So in the back of my brain from kind of the beginning was always kind of a like, that doesn't quite make sense. And even though I had experiences and lucid dreamed and left my body and came back. And if you've studied lucid dreaming, there's kind of these markers of like, sometimes you come back into your body and you kind of have some paralysis. And so it's momentary paralysis, and it's hard to get yourself moving again. And all of that has been scientifically noted. I don't know I can't quote a study or anything, but like this stuff has been studied.
Sleep paralysis. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
One of the things that you're supposed to do during your day, if you become a Gnostic, is no longer consume negative things. So, and I mean that in a metaphorical way. So you're being careful with what media you choose to involve yourself with. You're reading only scriptural books. You're not going to the movie theater. You're not watching lustful films or scary films.
I'm out.
Yeah, right. Because if you are involved in negative things or stimulating your mind too much, it'll show up in your lucid dreaming in a negative way. And so that's their proof, is like, if you only consume these positive things, you'll have these spiritual experiences. But if you consume these negative, mundane things, then you'll just be mundane and asleep consciously, which is incorrect, because you can lucid dream and still be consuming this stuff. So what makes these experiences subjective versus objective? You know, for Samael, it was like, I had these spiritual experiences, so that's truth with a capital T, versus a subjective experience, which is just your mundane life, which it's like, well, how is it truth objective rather than a subjective thing that you might be able to learn from psychologically, because you can learn things through your dreams about you, but it doesn't make it truth with a capital T and like, oh, I'm going to create a religion over this experience I had.
Right, right. Would the news fall under negative?
To a certain extent, because it gets really complicated, because it's not like, there's not anyone over your shoulder watching and managing you on a microscopic level. It's just strongly suggested. Like, this is how you become a good Gnostic, is following these specific guidelines.
Okay.
And most people are wanting to be dutiful and good, especially with spiritual stuff in hand. So most people would follow the explicit and implicit instructions, because there's both.
Right. But of course, like, reading books that are not spiritual books is negative, because that's
because
somehow...
it's just a story. It's just fiction.
Yeah.
And fiction is imagination being used incorrectly.
Right.
Unless it's something like The Hobbit, or, you know, some older, you know, everything had to be old, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He was really against the 60s. Like, he hated that turn of the decade.
Wow. So when did it become like, okay, I have a crush on this guy, we'll go to this lucid dreaming workshop and become something that you're like, I will spend 16 years doing this?
So we went to a meditation retreat held at the missionary's house, and it was really nice. It was quiet. I'd never gone on a meditation retreat before. And when you slow yourself down, like, you can feel yourself a little better, right?
Yeah.
And so
totally. You're
like, oh, I'm noticing I have emotions, and maybe that's emotional to have emotions. And so your experience is just that you're aware of yourself more, which isn't a bad thing.
And which is going to happen in general when you go on a meditation retreat and become still. And
regardless of whether it's Gnostic or Buddhist or fill in the blank.
Right.
So we went on a meditation retreat, and the other fork, so lucid dreaming is one of the big forks in the road for Gnosis. And the other gigantic blaring fork in the road is the sexual alchemy piece.
Ooh.
And that's the part where you can only have a partner of the biological opposite sex. Gay people aren't really, can't really get past public level. So there's a hierarchy. There's public level, first chamber, second chamber, etc. And you can't really get past the public level if you're gay or trans or any of that. Like, they might let you in and see it, but you don't get the candy.
Right.
Right.
You have to be hooked up in order to awaken your consciousness fully. You have to be with a partner.
Oh.
You can, if you are single and you end up staying single, you can awaken your consciousness to about 50%. I don't understand this percentage stuff.
Because you're only half a person.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, we're not complete.
Yeah, that other fork in the road is like the problem. However, my friend was really like, oh my God, this is my path. I'm going to walk this. And will you be my wife?
What?
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, I will say the positive part of my life in Gnosis is my husband. We're still married. I don't know.
You're still married?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. 19 years this
summer. Wow. Oh my gosh. So he leaves the girl that he's with, essentially, as you guys get deeper into this thing. How long did it take to go from like the toe dipping to like, oh, this is something I really want to explore more full time?
7 months.
Okay. Solid.
And I was thinking of leaving if you read the books, they're very incoherent and they're kind of cruel. Self-compassion is not a thing. So I was ready to leave. And then Justin was like, will you be my alchemical wife? And I'm like, fuck.
Alchemical. Alchemy? So alchemy is...
Yeah.
Okay.
Alchemy is sex.
Mm.
Yeah. There's all of these different terms for sex. You tried not to say sex. You didn't want to be too graphic.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want to be lewd.
And alchemy is used because there's an element of unlocking of spirituality that comes with sex, right?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Can you tell us what that is?
Okay. I'll just be really explicit, and I hope that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So the idea with it, and there's different practices in other religions, so Samael based this practice off of those. The basic idea of the practice is that you come together as man and wife and you have sex, but generally with as little movement as possible, because you don't want to overstimulate the glands and have an orgasm, because the orgasm is the energy that you collect and you use to pull up through your spine. And as you do this, you are... If you say a prayer to get rid of an ego, then that energy can be used to get rid of an ego, or if you are praying for a particular health thing that will cure your health thing, or if you're trying to awaken your consciousness and have an experience, a lucid experience or an experience in your meditation, then that will aid you because this is the elixir of long life. Mm. You will become eternal by conserving your energy.
So having a lot of sex, but having no orgasms.
Ideally, if you are of the appetite, having sex every day, but once a day and not having an orgasm.
And so how long, like, do you just do it? I'm sorry to get this. It's like,
no, you can ask whatever.
I'm like, is it just a quick dip? Like, how much sex are you supposed to have if you're trying to avoid orgasm?
It depends on the practitioners. You can have sex for as long as you want, as long as you're not having an orgasm. And, you know, there were times where we would have me and my husband would have a session that would last an hour.
Wow, that sounds so frustrating.
I mean, it's edging, right? It's edging.
For every day? Never, ever? I mean, that's intense.
No, because you are using your own will to have an orgasm, which is basically flipping your fingers off at God.
Right.
Because the energy isn't for you as a person. That is for God.
The most pressing question that comes up for me with this is, like, what about, like, nocturnal emissions? Like,
well, you're really sad and you pray because you're really sad it happened. Like,
wow.
it's bad that it happens, but it's right. Worse if you're on the physical plane because you're in a denser layer of existence, and that's your own self-will, where you can be pulled into having an orgasm if you're in a more subtle plane.
I see.
Because there are more planes past the fourth dimension, the more subtle the enticements can be.
And so if you accidentally, if like you're trying very hard not to and it just happens, like, is there some kind of like repentance process? Like, what does that look like?
There's lots of prayer. I mean, in the books, it's written that you should never, ever have an orgasm. And then if you do, you're A, you're being willful about it, and B, you're harming your divine mother, because you have a parental component. You have your being, which is your father, and you have your divine mother. And you have your Christ child that is within that you're trying to grow by all these practices. Mm. Because you as a person is sinful, egoic, bad, wrong, etc. Deluded even. You know, you're just in delusion. You live in delusion and your psychology is asleep. So the only way to awaken that is through these specific practices. Now, me specifically, I started having a problem not having an orgasm because that's how genitals work.
Right.
Yeah, which created a great deal of shame and worry and self-punishment because I couldn't stop it. It wasn't right. Like, I'm going to have an orgasm. Woo, it's the best orgasm.
Yeah.
We actually became painful. I'm not trying to have it happen. So I'm trying to
keep
it in. And so physically it was painful. Emotionally it's painful. Mm. And I worried that I was bringing my husband down to hell.
Oh my gosh.
It was just this pressure. So there are layers of people who are influencers, if you will, in Gnosis. So they're, you know, you have the missionary baseline, and then you have the people who have awoken their consciousness some. And so they tend to have more influence because they're purified and they know things. I would go and I would ask these other people, how can I stop this from happening? And I would get, I'm not praying hard enough. I need to do more pranayama, which is a breath exercise. I'm hurting my divine mother and I need to stop that. And
oh my God.
This was my, and oh, it's fine. It's usually, it'll probably go away. It's more of a problem for your husband. Work on it. You know, when you're about to have an orgasm, that's what I, you know, and sometimes I did and sometimes I didn't.
Wow. Dude. Oh my God. I just can't imagine the shame and like rebuilding your sex life after must have been a whole ordeal. Like
nearly as bad as one would think.
That's good. Yeah. I want to talk for a second about Samael. That's how you say it.
So, Samael Onbior.
Where was he from?
Colombia.
Okay. So he was Colombian.
Yes. He was born Colombian. He had a normal human, you know, name. That was his awakened consciousness name. That was the name of his internal being, the angel of Mars.
Did everyone have to change their names, or was that just a him thing?
Only if you're awake.
Okay.
Only if you're fully awake or awake to a certain level.
Okay.
And then it's no longer you receiving the benefits. It's your being and your God, your internal God, receiving the benefits. So you try to remove yourself completely from the equation as much as possible and just become a...
Like a vessel.
Yeah.
So he was called the Master, right? That's what. Mm-hmm. Okay. There is a website for this group. I went to the Resurrection Process page.
Yeah.
So there was a whole story, and I'm just going to read it out loud, and hopefully I'm not jumping ahead too much, but I'm just going to read a little quote here. So someone wrote this story, and you can tell me who it was that wrote this, but this is after Samael dies, I think. Someone is writing this, and they're saying they went to visit his body and have a visitation with him because he was supposed to be resurrected. Quote, "Suddenly, the unexpected happened. The Master opened his eyes with a faraway gaze into the infinite sky. They were eyes of amazement. This is while his dead body, or rather of great mystical ecstasy. This was shocking for me. It was even more shocking when the Master sat up and his arms, which were crossed like the Egyptian pharaohs, opened out in the form of a cross, and an abundant amount of blood spurted out of the stigmata in his palms, which splashed onto my white shirt, which I watched in amazement. I also saw that this blood fell on those who only a moment ago were contemplating him. Out of that entire great moment, what struck me most was the Master's gaze toward the infinite sky." So first of all, who wrote this?
If I had to guess, it would be Vargas, who is the main director of our particular sect of Gnosis, because as the Master dies, splinters happen. So like different groups were like, no, we're going to work this way. We're going to work this way. It's like Protestantism and Catholicism.
Right.
Like, right. Everyone's going to look at it a different way. So I don't know exactly who wrote it. My guess would be Vargas, who is in Rome, and he's our director, our main director.
Wow. Okay. So is resurrection a part of the teachings?
Yes. So resurrection happens if you are mostly awake. Returning happens when you're asleep. So psychologically. So you and I, other basic people or people who have only completed the path to a certain extent, just return. And based on your karma, good, bad, you have good, bad placement of where your fetus arrives.
Okay. Wow.
So it's not quite resurrection then. It's
only resurrection if you're awake.
Right. Otherwise, it's just normal run of the mill past life, new life.
Yeah.
Like
you might get born to so and so, or you might get born. But if you're awake, that means you get to return to exactly the point from which you left, and you get to complete the path, or you get to use your body.
I'm of the thought that I do really think people like Eckhart Tolle or whatever have collapsed their ego and are living in a perpetual state of oneness. So I completely believe that that's possible. Was there any good that came out of spending this much time meditating, collecting like sexual energy? I mean, what was happening with people?
I can really only speak for myself. My own experience, there were positive things. There were definitely, I mean, I grew the fuck up. You know, I was in my early 30s and still very mousy and still very unsure about the ways of the world. And this gave me an answer. Like I could put all of my energy into this and study it and feel confident that this was the path. We were told this was the path. There is no other path. Everyone else is deluded. They might be on a good path for them. Like, oh, I'm a Christian or I'm a Hindu. But their path has an end point, whereas Gnosis took you all the way to full consciousness.
Right.
So I was on the path with a capital T. And, you know, there's confidence with that. And you're learning the mist. Like there was a magical thing about it. Like there's this mystery that you're solving bit by bit because you're learning about like what the Masons really were and how you can look at ancient art and see that it's all about the sexual teaching, like all of the great masters of art, they were showing you like, you know, the statue of David, which we all can have a picture of in our mind. That's the last point where David is going to slay his ego. And he did it through sexual alchemy. That's why he was so beautiful. You know, you could look at a picture and know that the secret of the sexual teaching was within it because these symbolisms and stuff. And
wow.
That was very magical. It felt amazing. It gave me this understanding of the world, like just a foundation of like awe and wonder about the world. And I was raised very secular. Like dad was an atheist. Mom was a non-practicing Baptist. Like no one pushed any religion on me. And while I wasn't even spiritual when I graduated college, I was curious about humanity and what it meant to be a person and how am I this thing? And so this kind of filled that niche for me post-college and massage school. It gave me some meat to chew on to understand intellectually, and it gave it an emotional component because it's meant to be this path of devotion to your divine mother. Like I learned how to meditate, not through the Gnostics. They teach awful meditation practices. So Justin and myself.
Really?
Yeah. It's not awful in terms of like they harm you. It's just like bad instruction. Like, it's just like, just be quiet. Like, what do you do with the quiet?
Right.
What do you do? Yeah. You're just sitting there stirring. So we did go to actual Buddhists. We were on the West Coast, thankfully. And so there's a couple of different meditation centers that have like different sects of Buddhism come in. Mm. And so we went to different Buddhists and learned how to meditate.
That's great that you were allowed to do that.
We were not. So our first instructor, he really did feel the pain of that lack of instruction. And I will say, I thank him very much for giving us sort of the idea and the encouragement to seek out meditation and from good instructors, because he would do the same thing. He would go and learn a technique and try to give it to us. And then when we became adults in the group, we were encouraged by him to go outside the box. Now, most missionaries will tell you, don't go outside the box of Samayo. Like, all you need to know is in the books. That's all you need to know. Mm. And my instructor, you know, was a rebel. He taught outside the box. He's still inside the box, but he teaches outside of it.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
I mean, I find it interesting when some of these groups combine all these different religions, but they like don't take the good parts. It's like there is a way to combine religions in a way that's really useful, but like you're not taking the self-compassion from Buddhism, for example. You're not taking the mindfulness and like how you just come back.
Well, the mindfulness, yeah, we were supposed to be quiet most of the day in our mind. You have this system called subject, object, location, and it's basically to get you to stop thinking. Like, it's a stop thinking technique, which can lead to mindfulness and it can lead to serenity, because you're not worrying about Ukraine and you're not worrying about Trump. So you're not filling your mind with the bad stimulus. You're managing your time and your energy and quieting down, and that can have a positive effect.
But the whole thing with mindfulness is that, like, supposed to be without shame and just noticing and then gently coming, you know, versus like, I think people tend to, regardless of the group, a lot of people think that meditation is supposed to just be like, well, just don't think. We're not capable
that's
of
how
not thinking.
That's taught in Gnosis, but that's why we went somewhere else to learn actual technique.
Right.
So I will give Gnosis credit in that it taught us how to observe ourselves and like, oh, what am I feeling and why am I feeling that? And do I need to be feeling that? And can I react in a different way? And it led to questions, which aren't necessarily a bad thing. But you're supposed to, in Gnosis, you are supposed to take those observations and then condemn yourself for what you have observed. So Gnostics have turned suffering into a virtue. One of the other components is to do practices that awaken your consciousness, and you're supposed to voluntarily suffer. And the voluntary suffering part is you sacrificing your interests, your personal desires, your self-compassion. And sacrificing that. You are supposed to become nothing. Which on a metaphorical level, sure. If you're a monk, maybe, because you're not in the world and trying to function in relationships in the same way. But I think it's damaging because you're still trying to be in the world and do these very intense practices that I think more often than not, monks are the ones doing that kind of level of inner work.
Right. Right. I get so angry at religions that tell people to feel bad about being a human person.
That's how mine was. It's called dying daily. You had to die daily, die daily, die daily.
Is that?
Yeah, that was actually one of the, dying while walking.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the name of the game growing up.
That came through from a second, we have two directors basically. One is in Rome and the other is in Australia. He taught those two things, dying while walking. So you're just shutting down any, like, I had a negative thought about Sally. Oh my God, I suck. And so you're like, I'm dying that, dying that, dying that. And then also that you should not have self-compassion. You should never give yourself self-compassion, because then you're just sitting in pity. You're feeling sorry for yourself and you're just stroking the ego. You're building your ego rather than dying. And so you should be accusing yourself. I don't know how they balance this. You shouldn't be mean to yourself, but you shouldn't be nice to yourself. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, because being mean to yourself is like also giving yourself too much attention, right?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
Don't focus on yourself too much, but just hate yourself casually.
But hate yourself, but not that much. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This sounds really easy to balance. Yeah.
Yeah. I heard you mention hell. So there was the Christian version of hell.
There was their version of hell. And it's not that you stay there for eternity. Oh. But if you die with your ego intact, and you get 108 lifetimes, by the way.
Okay.
You get 108 chances. Unless you're super evil and like kill babies or kick puppies, you lose a couple of lifetimes if you're super bad. But everyone is born their first round, they get 108 rounds. And on your 108th, if you haven't done anything with your ego, if you've just been super selfish or super lustful, being a normal human, then you go to hell and your ego has to be dissolved. And upon completion of that dissolution, that dissolving, you are then granted back into the absolute. You're granted back into heaven, but you have no awakened consciousness of it. So you're like an ant in heaven, the drop in the ocean. Rather than being the ocean, you are the drop in the ocean.
Wait, what?
You just aren't conscious that you're everything. But you're not in hell anymore. You're not being tortured. Yeah. You're just
this pure, innocent spark of energy that has no attachment to anything. But hell could feel like eternity. It could go on for another eon. So it might as well be awful. And the more conscious you are when you die, the more you're going to feel that as you dissolve.
Oh, that's 107 too many lives for me.
Yeah. Also, clearly it sounds like the directors need to go to OCD therapy, which will teach you that thoughts are just random generation, like random noise that your brain is generating.
That's you thinking bad things. You have to stop thinking bad things.
So you're learning all of this. Are you guys like living somewhere with other people, or you're just sort of living a normal life and going to meetings? Like, how does it work?
Originally, we were just living in a separate place and just going to meetings. And our personal missionary ended up buying a house that had a basement apartment. So Justin and I lived in there and we kind of communed. I wouldn't say it was a commune, but it was like we were just surrounded by people who were involved in the cult. Mm. It was very unattached, but you definitely met often. Our missionary taught 3, 4, 5 times a week.
So what does that mean?
You're going to meetings and he's teaching you about gnosis. And there are different levels. There's the public level. There's the first chamber level. There's the second chamber level and the third chamber level. Now, second chamber and on gets interesting because you get a vestment, you get a garment, and then there's a temple in the home and you get to LARP all these religious activities.
There are so many terms to learn. I need like a dictionary for this.
Are you saying like live action role play?
Yes. Just
like,
what? Yeah, I say it with amusement and disdain, both.
Wow. Do they call it LARPing?
No. Okay. No, that's me. Okay. That's all me.
I was like, this is some new term. There's no way she can mean actual LARPing.
No, okay. they would be super offended by my derogatory term.
Got it.
It's meant to be a very sacred. It's basically church in your house.
So when you get to a certain level, you get a garment and then you can do like rituals in it? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. There's two caveats. You have to be not drinking, not drugging, and it doesn't have to be perfect, but you have to be on board with the sexual teaching. Like there can't be like a question about the sexual teaching. Like, well, maybe sometimes I'll have an orgasm. Like, no. No one's checking on you. No one's going into your bedroom, be like,
Did you get one of the cool outfits?
Oh, not only did I get a cool outfit, I became a missionary. My husband and I became a missionary in 2007. So we got to teach the teaching.
Did you end up like recruiting anyone ever, or it was just teaching people who already believed?
Lord bless Portland. Portland, Oregon is a special place, and you could just put up flyers and people would come. I don't know why. I don't know why they came. So that was our level of recruitment, was putting up flyers for a lucid dreaming course or study Kabbalah with us. Be neat spiritual people. The caveat on that is we never promoted Christianity, and it's very much a Catholic-like faith. So you start out with the weird Hindu stuff and the alchemy stuff, not the sexual alchemy, like, oh, study these interesting symbols that these really ancient people thought was, I'm going to make gold.
Right.
So you study meditation with them or lucid dreaming or et cetera. And as you stayed in, it became more and more about the Christian faith.
Megan, we should go on a road trip and just go to every weird thing that has a flyer of it. Side note, every weird like seminar.
Yes.
This sounds great. Did you learn how to develop the skill of lucid dreaming?
To a certain extent.
Okay.
It takes a lot of dedication. And I had experiences and a lot of them were kind of negative. I also had a lot of fear because like, oh, what I'm going to see is going to tell me about how awake I am, how sinful I am. And so I think that just kind of intermingled with the possibility of lucid dreaming. And so what I would end up having lucid dreams about was me kind of like attacking myself or symbology that like gave me a negative self-confirmation. That makes sense. The suffering part kind of adds a sucky flavor to, for lack of better words, to the sexual piece that I was having a problem with, because you're supposed to be suffering in gnosis. Like that's just part of it, you know, voluntarily you should feel pain. So if you're feeling pain, you're kind of doing it right. So it becomes this kind of vicious loop of like,
exactly,
oh, I'm experiencing pain with this religion. I guess I'm doing it right.
Right.
And so I'm trying to shove my square peg into this round hole and wondering why I'm not fitting.
Right.
And so I'm not questioning, should I leave? Is this healthy? So that's, I think, the danger, the sort of subtle danger of gnosis is that it doesn't allow you to question it. It doesn't allow you to have critical thinking about it. I was a very skeptical person before I entered gnosis and I had to turn that part of my brain off.
Yeah.
Luckily, I'm getting to, you know, get some oil on it and, you know,
sounds pretty
on rusty wheels. So
I feel like the trick is either if people are suffering, tell them it's because they're doing it wrong. Or in the case of this group, tell them that they're doing, that means they're doing it right. Oh, you feel pain.
It's a little bit of both because you can't be, remember, it's kind of like you can hate yourself, but not
you
too
can't
much.
Be too negative. Right.
You have to, this weird balance, they call it walking the razor's edge. So,
but either way, it's a way of teaching you that the signals in your body that tell you that something is wrong are
the emotions
unimportant.
That you have. Yes. That are saying this is punishing, this is abuse, you know, sure. Maybe you're doing it to yourself, but it's an abusive cycle. It's being supported by the people around me. You know, they're all abusing themselves too.
Oh, it's so insidious. So Samael is dead. So it broke off into a couple of groups.
Yep.
So did the new group, your group, would you say that Vargas is similarly like, was it kind of just like he replaced Samael or is it more spread out in terms of the hierarchy?
I think more spread out because I'd never had a whole lot of contact with him. I think I met him twice after our missionary training, which was 3 months. And then you're responsible for people's spiritual and psychological well-being. You know, I mean, monks and nuns and chaplains, they study much longer and study, like, you know, so most people's problems were outside of our scope of practice, basically. And granted, Justin and I, we knew that. And so anybody who needed more help psychologically than we could offer, it's like, here's some references, go see these people. That doesn't happen in a lot of Gnostic circles. Like you're supposed to get your healing through the group. Psychological trauma is not really being addressed properly. It's another thing I would say about that.
Right.
But you were going to ask me a question about Vargas. I didn't meet him very often. No.
But he's not like sending out directives to people below him, which go to the people below them. And
a little bit of that. I mean, the directives weren't very directive. They were like, this was my experience lately. And so you should teach about that in your own way. So we would get emails every other week, every week sometimes. And it would be like, I have this experience in the astral plane. And isn't that neat?
That's so interesting how, I mean, I guess it happens a lot, but, you know, Megan's old religion is a good example of just like how a religion can live on or a cult can live on without the original leader who made it all up, you know.
Well, you know, there are people that end up taking the place of that, the other missionaries, and they have influence. And they, I do not believe anybody in Gnosis currently has any nefarious intentions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they all are, believe their thing. They believe this teaching. They're all doing it with good intentions.
Do they take a lot of money?
The missionaries are meant to be supported by the students and that they are called students, not members. And that depends on how rich the area that you live in is, but there's no demand. That's another tricky part. So like, please donate to the center or the church, but there's no expectation of level or amount. It's just like, please support us, or, hey, we're going to have a garage sale. Please donate some items that you'd like to be sold, but mm-hmm. we keep the money, that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Okay. So you're going to stuff multiple times a week. You're surrounded by people. The two of you become missionaries yourselves. You're working like a regular job while this is all happening.
Yep. So okay. Because we live in America where the cost of living is as high as it is, especially in Portland, as high as it was, we couldn't not work full-time jobs. So Justin, who was thinking of going back to school to get a degree, ended up just in semi-truck driving, but locally. So he was like delivering items locally so that he was home every night. And I was a massage therapist. That was kind of an easy thing to work around in my schedule.
Right.
But we're still working. By the time we took over the school in Portland, we were working full-time jobs and teaching 4 and 5 nights a week and writing lectures and preparing for that and doing the rituals.
So no free time?
None. No.
Not a second.
So, not a second. No. That's sort of the ideal. Not that you're working. Actually, it'd be better if you lived as simply as possible and as poorly as possible, because that's good to destroy the ego, because it's your ego that wants goodies.
Right.
Like heat.
Oh.
Whoa. Mm-hmm.
Water.
Heat is water. For the ego. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So ideally, you shouldn't buy a house. Ideally, you shouldn't invest in your retirement, because it's also an Armageddon cult. So the world is ending, and pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
We had a date for a while, but that passed. So
when was it?
Vargas had said that he had an experience that in 2015, the New York would sink into the ocean either by a catastrophic explosion or a natural occurrence, like a tsunami or something. And that it didn't happen.
And you were still in the group when this happened?
Yes, we had moved to Spokane at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been here since 2012.
So what did you think?
What did I think? Well, I had allowed myself to stay on the wagon, basically. And once that didn't happen, because I was like, oh, man, if New York explodes, I am so on board. I am so a Gnostic. I am.
Yeah.
There was this push pull with the skeptical brain in me that wouldn't quite shut the fuck up during all of this. And plus the sexual aspect I was having so many problems with, and the shame and the suffering aspect. And like, all of this is a weight, and all of our responsibilities as missionaries to uphold the school and to take care of these people and take care of people in a way that I cannot do that. Like, I'm not trained as a psychologist. I'm just a person. And so these people's well-being, spiritual and mental and emotional well-being, I'm in charge of. And even though at that point I was like, in my really late 30s, it's like, I still wasn't, you know, sure, I've matured, but I'm not prepared to take care of people in this way. So I was wanting in and out and in and out and in and out. But I also knew that if I left the school, if I left the teaching, I'd have to leave my husband, because there's no way a missionary couple stays together if one of them is like, I'm out.
Right.
I witnessed lots of divorces just on the public and the first chamber level. Like, people would split up because like one person was in and the other one was out. But like, how do you have sex with somebody when, you know, they're talking about such a personal aspect of someone's life? And how do you have sex with someone that isn't interested in having sex the way that you are? That should be a combined thing. You know?
So side note, isn't it bad for men's bodies? Like, doesn't it put them at a higher risk for cancer or something if they never orgasm? There's like something. Oh no, it found men who ejaculated the most had a 20% lower chance of prostate cancer versus those who ejaculated 4 to 7 times a month. It is real, guys. It's real. Just a health thing. A side note, I love how much you from the beginning just like loved Justin, like, and you were like, stay, you're like ride or die, right?
Yeah, we had known each other. He was from Pittsburgh. I lived and grew up in Colorado. We met in Colorado, and there was something weird about the two of us that it couldn't quite fit it together at that time, because it was always someone was in the way, some other guy, some other woman. And so it was like, well, we'll just stay in contact, you know. So this is before pagers.
Wow.
We would email each other, and sometimes because we got we both got really transient with our young adult lives. Like, he went off to California to be in a rock band, and I went off to New Zealand for a while, and we would write each other's parents.
Wow.
Because they weren't going anywhere. We were all over the place. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. And I very much had this weird affinity. There's no one else in the entire my existence that I've met that I feel as close to, as normal, as okay in my body and my sense of myself as with Justin. Like, there's no one else on that. Yeah. And I don't know why or how I got that lucky. If God exists, thank you. Like, I, you know, I have lots of questions about that now, but beside the point, like, I don't know whatever brought us together. Cause it, I adore him.
It's miraculous that you guys made it through this thing. So I guess I'm wondering, like, how did you first start, like, talking about, maybe this is kind of weird. Like, what was that like?
Well, for me, kind of one of the nails in the coffin, one, because there's several, was the 2015 thing. Like, oh, it didn't happen. And the story that got pushed around, the excuse was that, oh, because there's enough Gnostics on the planet right now.
Oh, God.
There was enough good juju that it didn't happen. No. So, again, like, he had a subjective experience that might have just been for him to learn something about, I don't know, exploding buildings.
There's always an explanation. There's always an explanation.
Yes, but that was kind of sent around as like an objective thing. And so that's one aspect. So we had moved from Portland to Spokane and left this Portland school in the care of a gentleman who moved from Australia to be the new missionary there. Kind of very quickly, there were red flags, but because we were committed to leaving and we had brought him over, it was like, okay, guess we'll just go with this. He was claiming he was awake completely and that he was sacrificing himself by being here on the planet still longer.
Oh,
yeah. So that's cool. Yeah. So he ended up dating one woman and then dating another one. And very quickly, like, he brought this, the first woman over from the East Coast and dated her for about like a month and was like, and then started dating one of the students. And that first person left and told us, like, he's fucked up. And we were like, no, he's not. He's fine. And so they ended up having a child. So I guess alchemy doesn't work all the time. And then the threads really fell apart. He was having an affair with one of the women and attempting another affair with two others.
Oh, no.
And this is the part that really broke my heart. It wasn't just that there was abuse and he ended up being this sociopath, essentially, if that, I don't know. He was just awful and deluded and taking advantage of his place of power and abusing the women there. Even by, in my opinion, even by trying to seduce other women while he's having an affair and being married, like, even though he didn't physically have an affair with the other two women, just the fact that you're in this such a great place of power and everybody is putting their spiritual well-being in you. You are the director and they're giving themselves over, maybe not physically yet, but like, that's still just awful abuse. And these were people who were our students. So it's like, we left the kids with an awful babysitter. Like, our level, our sense of responsibility of this was so extreme. And so we wanted to come to Portland to help and take care of them. And we were told not to because we were too attached. And it really crushed me. Like, it really...
Told by who?
We were told by the Seattle couple who came down. The Seattle couple includes, and I say couple of missionaries, the couple that ran the Seattle school, the wife of that couple was a mental health counselor. There's several mental health counselors on the West Coast that are still in Gnosis. I cannot fathom that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's weird. It's really weird. I don't know what their cognitive dissonance is to allow themselves to be in something this cruel. So they came down to take care of the students. And basically what they did was they tried to find a scapegoat and protect the optics of Gnosis. And that's my take on it. I don't think that was their intention. I think that was their intention was to make sure everybody was fine, but let's not make too big a deal of this. Let's just calm down. Let's not be reactive. And let's just, and for me, like, I wanted to go there And I wanted to scream and I wanted to cry and I wanted to validate their pain and their experience and shame him because he was the fucking one that was responsible.
Yeah.
He had broken this woman that he had the actual affair with because he was telling her as he's having sex with her, maybe not in the moment, but he's telling her that he's cleaning up her karma so that she won't have to go to hell.
Oh, no. No.
Yeah. By having sex with her while he's married to somebody else.
God, so horrible.
If he had not had a child here in the States with the woman that was his wife, because everything fell apart for him in many ways. I would have reported him. Like,
right.
I was that angry, but he had a kid and I wasn't going to go down that path.
So is his life just destroyed now?
He's such a narcissist. I know a little bit because I still am in contact with his wife. I mean, he's such a narcissist that he's fine. He's going to always be fine. Like, he's such a deluded human being.
Right.
He's no longer in Gnosis and he's no longer teaching.
That's good.
But the students were given the choice. Like, do you still want Davin to teach you? Which I'm like, oh my God. No. Like, how do you do that? Like, we're going to send away our teacher who's been telling us he's awake. How do you put that on the students to choose? Like, that's like saying your dad who's been incesting you, like, stay, you know, do you want him to go to jail?
Right.
Like, it's that totally. Kind of, to me, that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know? But that's me. And so that was in 2016. And things are really falling apart for me. I'm still in it, but I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And I continue going to the Buddhist retreats rather than the Gnostic retreats. And
rebellious. Cool.
Yeah. And they would ask, where's Lynn? And Justin was like, you know. And then in 2018, I had a really great meditation retreat with some of the Buddhists. And I came home and it was like, I can't do it anymore. I can't pretend. There's so much pain and so much shame and so much resentment and so much regret that I can't possibly do this anymore. And that meant probably leaving Justin. And so I talked to him and it wasn't an ultimatum. It was just like, sweetie, if this is your path, this is your path. Please, please, please stay on the path if this is what you want. But I am going to have to go. And that means I can't be in the house. I can't be with the books. I can't be with the vestment. I can't be in the temple. Like, I can't do any of it. And so we had been in talks with that. He and I, like, what would it mean for me to leave? What would it mean for him to stay? And we were kind of in this limbo of not quite making a decision because we care very much for each other. I did call the people in Seattle and another woman that I didn't have to leave officially. I didn't have to go and tell the director and, you know, but I called these people because they'd been in my lives for years, you know, over a decade at this point. And I told them that I was leaving. And they were very condescending about it. Sweet, but very condescending. Kind of like pat me on the head kind of thing. Like,
you're missing out.
Yeah. And like the woman from Seattle was like, isn't it great how much Gnosis has grown and evolved and how much kinder it is? And I'm like, what Kool-Aid are you drinking?
Where are you looking? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, they both were like, well, I guess we won't talk to you anymore. So that's neat. So all this time, all this friendship, just gone out the window.
Right.
Man.
And so it felt like free fall. It felt like I was damned and I was surely going to go to hell because I was saying no to the path. You know, they're very clear that this is the path.
Right.
I get that feeling.
Yeah. And so I found a book online. I'm like, I have to do something. I don't know if I need therapy. I can't afford therapy. So I found this book and it was like leaving the cult. And I'm like, great, I'll get it. And it asked basic open-ended questions evaluating the group that you were in. And I got to like really pull the sleeping, skeptical, critical brain into action again and looking at the good and the bad. And there's way more cons than pros in Gnosis. So I did the work in that book and I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but Facebook and social media is what it is. So I posted something on Facebook about how this was going to be my life now. And I didn't criticize Gnosis. It wasn't like, fuck those people and Vargas sucks and Samael. None of it was just like, this is my life now. I have a new life. 2 days later, Justin was kicked out of the cult.
Oh, no.
No one contacts us except for one person. One person contacts us. No one called to check in. No one called to, like, check, like, oh, is this, are you leaving too? Like, no questions. Just kicked him out. So while my process has been one of rage and burn the house down and fuck all this, and Justin's has been one of grief and loss.
Yeah, so
that's hard.
It's been an interesting dance. Like, we're in a really good space now. It's been about 3 years, so almost four, I guess. And so it's been an interesting dance to watch how my anger and rage has come down as I'm leaving and healing, and his has kind of bumped up a little bit.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, this is fucked.
Yeah.
And
I was going to say, you had a whole pandemic to sit with that rage.
There's a little of that. There's a little of that. I was able to continue working with masks and stuff.
Oh, like, good.
I was able to, and Justin was an essential employee, so he didn't
cool.
really take a whole lot of time off. I was down for 2 months, and then they were like, if you follow these parameters, you can come back to work and touch people.
Right.
Nice. Is the cult still going strong? Like,
oh yeah, for sure.
Wow. Is it growing?
Sure. That I wonder about, because that same month that I called and told the women that I was leaving, two other things happened that definitely certified, yes, leave now and never look back. There was a missionary woman with her husband in Boulder, and she committed suicide, and she might have had emotional problems. I doubt seriously gnosis helped her, probably made it worse. I would bet money that her reasons for ending her own life were related to the Gnostic doctrine. This is a very young couple, so they're in their early 20s. The husband of that couple grieved for about a month and then started dating his student.
Oh, God.
So super healthy
wow.
ways to deal with big major changes in your life. And we are taught in Gnosis not to grieve the loss of a loved one, that you are harming them if you cry and have big emotions about their. You can be a little bit sad. Again, you can be a little bit sad. Yes. Because you're harming them in their process of death. So they can't let go. You're still staying attached. What? So they can't. Yeah. So
you're harming them after they're dead. By being sad. So you're just not allowed to feel any big of your emotions. Feelings or any of your physical feelings.
You can't
be
dramatic.
Feel happiness. You can feel happiness, especially devotionally.
Mm.
That's, you know, that's proper emotion. You can be angry. You can be frustrated, but you can't be angry. You know, like, you have to be in this level of emotion where you can respond to it rather than be reactive. You know, which isn't human. That's not like, maybe again, maybe if you are a monk and sequestered from humanity and like that's your purpose and you're working on yourself, like, sure.
Even then, monks feel feelings. They just deal with them differently. They just,
I think,
like,
that's the think that's the idea, is that you have emotions, but you deal with them differently. But you're talking about the teaching is brought to people who have, you know, day one, you're learning about how you shouldn't have these particular emotions, or, you know, so like,
therapized, like, little person in me is like, everybody has the feelings, and the more that we deny them, the more the bigger that they get, you know, like, it's just like all of these
which
things.
Is the problem, like, people spiritualize their repression.
Right. Exactly. And it's so harmful. And the fact that there could be therapists who are subscribing to this, well, I mean, like, what are they telling their patients then, or their clients, or whatever the fuck?
Olivia, I'll say her name. I'm trying to be very careful and not say names, but I think Olivia should be honored in that. I don't know all of the details of her story and why she killed herself, and her husband, who I don't remember his name. You know, like, I can't imagine he being very healthy, having made those choices. Maybe he's an asshole for making those choices, but also maybe he's just not dealing with his grief. Like, I don't know his inner motivations.
Well, he's probably in a lot of pain and has no coping mechanisms.
Just repressing it. Because you're supposed to be hooked up, because you can't waken your consciousness unless you're having sex.
Right.
So all of this pressure, all of these.
I forgot.
Yes. So, yes.
Right.
So she killed herself. And I don't know the details why. And then the other thing that happened was a woman in Seattle came to the missionary couple, the wife of that missionary couple in Seattle, and told her that her husband was raping her on a regular basis.
Oh, no.
Because she, the nights that she wouldn't want to have sex, you're supposed to be having sex as often as possible. She didn't want to have sex. And so she was repressing the fact that he was having non-consensual sex with her, not ejaculating, but having non-consensual sex with her because what you're supposed to do. I mean, not maybe not the non-consensual part, but she's supposed to suffer again. She's supposed to be voluntarily. Yes. So she finally couldn't take it anymore. And that whole story got kind of spilled out into the grapevine, but I was still kind of, I had a tether to the grapevine. So I found out those stories. I'm no longer attached. I don't find out anything anymore. And if I remember correctly, I think she, the missionary wife, became the counselor for that young woman, which I find ethically questionable.
Wait,
yeah, that's
she
strange.
Should have had a neutral source rather than someone who is promoting gnosis necessarily.
Right.
Yeah. This isn't that important, but I'm just like a little bit confused about the hierarchy of it. So like when you guys left, what level were you at?
We were missionaries.
We were missionaries.
Yeah. So the hierarchy is you have the students, members, you have the students, and you have the missionaries, and then you have the couple of directors. But within that missionary level, you have influencers. So you've got the cliquey missionaries that are getting the work. They understand the work. And so they're promoting certain ideas, and they get, you know, they're basically just people who grok the teaching and can talk articulately about it and can perform in front of an audience. Right.
And who decides who becomes that?
It just kind of happens organically. There's no decisions. It's that just happens in group mechanics. Right.
Yeah.
Some people get more popular. It's high school.
But it's not like an actual structure of like these people are above. Okay.
No.
Got it. So when
it
you
just happens kind of organically.
When you were being told what to do or what not to do, that was coming from the like other missionaries or directors?
Pretty much. Because we would meet on a fairly, the missionaries would try to meet once a year nationally and internationally once a year. So ideally you were required sort of, like if you were broke ass poor, you didn't have to come to these retreats, but you were pretty much required, you know, part of your job description basically was to come to these retreats, the national retreat and then the international retreat.
Were they fun?
No. Lola, no one's coming. It's not fun.
Listen, the NXIVM retreat seemed really fun other than the abuse.
I hated them because, A, the meditation instruction was awful. Like, just the basic practical, like, it was always awful. Like, it just sucked. But then everybody's there sort of, they would never admit to it, but everyone's competing. Like, how many classes are you teaching? How many students do you have? You know, how many retreats are you putting on?
Right.
Do you ever take a vacation? Like, all this implicit, like, expectation is being placed and talked about amongst the missionaries. And yeah, sure, that's probably what you're supposed to be working on and not worrying about whether you're keeping up with the Joneses or whatever. But, like, that's sort of what the mechanics became. Like, that's what group dynamics is about. So
group dynamics suck,
it's
man.
it's a results driven religion, and you have the impending doom of Armageddon coming. Like, we don't know when that's going to happen, but we sure as hell want to be good Gnostics, because it's not Gnostics that win heaven, it's the good Gnostics who are doing the work properly, and the world is going to go to smithereens and the good Gnostics are going to inherit the earth. The golden age will begin.
Yay. Of course. Yeah. In my head, I was like, well, a retreat, maybe they have like good food and dancing, but it
depends
like
on where it was. No dancing.
Too joyful.
Yeah.
Okay. And we'll wrap up in a second, but I'm just on the website and I'm looking at contact, and there's a different contact page for each country. So there are do you say new Gnostics or just Gnostics?
Gnostics. My particular group is calling it something else now, you know, and that's fine. But Gnostics in general. And it doesn't have a lot to do with the archaic Gnostics of old Christianity. There's not a lot of similarities.
Right. Okay. Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, Colombia, Costa Rica, Deutschland, Germany, Spain, Italy, Mexico, New Zealand, Puerto Rico, UK, US, and Uruguay. That is a lot of countries. It's very surprising for something we've never heard of. And like,
how many people do you think are in it?
the last international retreat I went to, it was a lot of people, but you know, there was maybe 500 people in the building, but that's a guess. Not everybody right. can come because they can't afford it.
Like, and, but right. that's not regular members though, or is it?
That's yeah. Internationally, the students are allowed to go.
Okay.
Nationally is meant for missionaries only.
Got it. Okay, so yeah. that's pretty, so it's pretty small. It's in the hundreds, maybe the thousands.
Maybe the thousands. New members are all the time, so.
Right.
How long they stay, I don't know, you know.
Right.
And now I don't have any fathoming of what the groups are like now. It's almost been 4 years since we left.
Wild.
So what is your biggest takeaway from this experience? What have you learned?
Well, you know, that kind of leads into the, you know, how is our life now? Kind of, there's been a lot of healing. I've been in therapy with a couple of different mental health counselors that one dealt with trauma and another is dealing specifically with religious trauma.
Oh, good.
I learned that not everything was awful. Like when I left, it was just, everything was just a solid fucking mess and everything was awful. And I wanted to hate everything about it. And that wasn't constructive either. It made sense at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to balance it with what were positives in Gnosis and what were the absolute by sure negatives has been good. I learned the most to be able to see the world in a different way. Granted, I'm doing that differently now. I don't feel like I'm in as much a state of delusion. I will say this whole experience has given me a lot of compassion for like the people in QAnon. Like,
yeah,
it's so enticing and so magical. And so in the beginning, you know, it's like, oh my God, all these things that are connecting and, mm-hmm. and I never saw the world this way. And oh my God, I can tell who the bad people are now. And, you know, so it gives me some empathy for people that are also in a cult.
That's cool.
At the end of the month, I'm being interviewed for recovering from religion to hopefully be a hotline person for people.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. So doing that, I'm going to write a chapter for a book and also recovering from religion. So they're doing chapter by chapter. Each chapter is a different religion or sect.
Awesome. I want to make a movie recommendation just for everyone.
Sure.
It's not for healing or anything. A couple of my friends made a movie over the pandemic called Something in the Dirt. They just made it themselves in the pandemic. It just went to Sundance. It's so cool.
Oh, really? Wow.
But it captures two men who like fall into sort of conspiratorial thinking. It's like the movie version of that meme that you referenced earlier where they're like making connections. Yeah. And the way that it ends to me, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but it basically just like captures how that kind of thinking never really leads us to the like holy grail of an answer that we're thinking it's going to. It kind of just leads us to more and more and more questions because it's ultimately just like noticing coincidences.
Patterns. We love our patterns.
Yeah. They're fun. They feel magical. They feel exciting. Yeah. It feels like it gives
us
meaning.
Well, they feel safe, too. They're like,
and you're making sense of the world.
Yeah.
The world is weird. Humanity is weird.
Yeah.
Like, why are some people nice and some people assholes? Like, that's a question.
Right. Yeah. Chaos sucks, man. We don't want to live in chaos. It's not fun, but.
Yeah. Here we are. I will say one other. I so appreciate what you guys are doing because, like,
thanks.
You and other podcasts are just like the golden nugget of like when I needed it the most, finding out how other people articulated their experiences helped me to be like, oh, that's not the same thing, but it's so similar. And I can articulate now, like, especially like the subjective experience being treated as an objective truth. Decoding the Gurus did a big deep dive on Jordan Peterson, who he's just a foul. And if you listen to Jordan Peterson, it's like listening to a Gnostic lecture. Like everything is this absolute and assurance and certainty. Everything is so certain.
Right.
And none of it has to be. And the other thing, he speaks so outside his scope of practice. Like he has to be able to speak on everything. And all the Gnostics I know have a fucking answer for everything, even if they have had no study in it at all. None.
Right.
Like
kind of like the internet
from their being.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I hate that. I hate that authoritative tone about things that people don't know anything about, which is like the entire internet this past week pertaining to Ukraine and Russia.
Yes.
But I get it. We all are just trying to like learn and trying to look like we know what we're talking about. But yeah, Jordan Peterson is not your guru.
No. But like listening to Conspirituality podcast or the QAnon Anonymous guys or you guys, like it's been really helpful. Like it's been such, I think, because there's like such a, maybe because of the pandemic, like lately there's been more information about control groups and cults and QAnon people. And like we're sort of in a phase of like pulling that stuff apart. And I think it's really important because like the cult can be a cult of two, like it mm-hmm. can just be a controlling relationship that you're in, and totally. To be able to have dialogue about what someone else's experience is, even if it's subjective, like this was my experience. Not all Gnostics are going to have this experience. Some of them will love this.
Of course.
Great.
Yeah.
Blessings to them.
Right.
But not everybody's going to have that experience. And because we're told we should suffer, they might just stay in longer than they need to.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I'm anti-suffering. Just going to put that out there. Think suffering is bad. Not condone it.
Discipline is one thing. Suffering is another.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Delay your gratification. But yeah. like... Yeah. Life should be generally like okay. Like
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. 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 No, whatever. That was it. Nothing interesting. Thank you so much for talking to us. This has been really incredible.
Thank you so
much. Thanks for talking to me.
Are you on social media? Is there anywhere people can find you?
You know, it's just me. I'm Lynn. I have an Instagram account. You know, it's. I
just
forget
Lynn
what it
Short.
Is.
Okay.
Sure it is.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you. I really appreciate the time.
Okay, y'all. Megan, it's that time of the day now where I ask you if you were exposed to a group like this, maybe say via a person you really liked, and they told you that lucid dreaming was one of the keys to spiritual enlightenment. What do you think? Would you be intrigued?
Yeah. I would go full N.
Yeah, tell me why.
Because I love lucid dreaming. I love anything to do with meeting deeper parts of yourself. I got really into lucid dreaming for a minute. All I did was read a pamphlet, and it was just like, check your watch throughout the day and then do it in your dream and the watch won't work. And I started doing that and just lucid dreaming all the time. It was so strange. Yeah.
Really?
And then I stopped doing it. It was very... odd, but I just love stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I was only, I mean, we said this earlier, but I think I was only into it because it was an opportunity to get to have sex when I wasn't allowed to in my real physical life. So once that no longer was an issue, spoiler, you guys, I have sex, I'm not a virgin, then it no longer seemed as necessary.
That's the funniest thing I've ever heard, Lola. Wow. Okay.
Even now, I'm like, yeah, I think that would intrigue me. I would want to go to it maybe like half jokingly, but just also kind of wanting to see what it was all about, because there's something inherently mystical seeming about being able to wake up while you're not awake.
Yeah, it's weird. It's the life within the life.
There's something sort of logical about conserving your orgasms, although that extreme of a degree, I definitely would struggle with.
Yeah, I also think, though, that especially for women, orgasms move out trauma and are really healing. So I don't think they're a conserving thing.
I don't know. There was a period in my life where I got really interested in the idea. This is going to be TMI.
I got really interested in solving crimes after not having an orgasm for months. That's what I imagine you to say.
There's a term called ejaculation, and there's like a, I can't even remember now. It was like a tantra thing, but it was like the male orgasm, when the semen goes back inside, it conserves your energy and you have more power.
Right.
And whereas I think the way that I think of a female orgasm is like, no, we don't get these enough and we need to have more of them because we don't, you know, that release doesn't.
The more the better.
Happen as organically and in our sleep as men, although I have had sleep orgasms.
Pleasure processes trauma.
It's so true. And as Esther Perel says, sex is the antidote to death. Like eroticism is the opposite of death. It's how
we
assert our life force.
That's really cool. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, settled.
That'll do. Thanks for spending another week with us, you guys. We can't wait to talk to you next week. For now, remember to follow your gut.
watch out for red flags, and never, ever, ever trust me. Bye.